Views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to Cultural Brilliance Radio, the DNA of organizational excellence with Claudette Rowley. Conversations that are transforming the world of culture and business. Claudette brings fresh, innovative perspectives that push the boundaries of what organizational cultures can and should be. Learn how to catalyze your organization's workforce into an authentic, intentional, and financially successful culture. Now here's your host, Claudette Rowley.
Hello, everyone. I'm Claudette Rowley, and you are listening to Cultural Brilliance, the DNA of Organizational Excellence on Transformation Talk Radio. Stay with us for the next hour, and we're going to help you experience some groundbreaking ways to transform your company culture. Twice each month, we would talk with some of the foremost experts on organizations and organizational culture, helping you understand how to make a brilliant culture the rule rather than the exception. Today, I am really excited to have Julie Wilson on the show, and Julie and I are going to be discussing the reality of change in today's organizations. We're going to look at this perspective on culture and change to help us understand how to create brilliant organizations and also what holds us back from creating that brilliance in organizations. Let me introduce Julie. Julie is the founder of the Institute for the Future of Learning, which is an organization dedicated to transforming how we educate in our country. And she's also a really well-known and extremely talented leadership change consultant and coach, and she's worked with a wide range of clients across the U.S. and Europe in helping them build skills around workplace change and cultural change and how to be more creative and collaborative and solve better problems better on their teams. And Julie, prior to that, Julie worked at Harvard University as a learning and development consultant. And I'm so thrilled to say that Julie is also part of Cultural Brilliance, that she and I work together on different cultural change projects, and she's definitely an advisor I turn to when I'm trying to figure out how to help organizations. So I'm really thrilled to be able to share that aspect of Julie's work with you as well. So welcome, Julie.
Thanks, Claudette. It's great to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited you're here. We're going to have such a great conversation.
Looking forward to it.
Looking forward to it. Absolutely. So as we're talking about the reality of change, we're talking about the reality of change in organizations. So what is the state of change you're seeing right now when you're working with organizations and teams?
Well, the state of change reflects the external environment in which we find ourselves, Claudette. There's a great acronym coined by the military a number of years ago where they were rethinking their strategy and coined the term VUCA, that we live in a volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous world. And what I'm seeing inside organizations is that we're catching up to that reality with the various change management models, structures, methodologies that we're using. In many ways, we're sort of in uncharted territory with regards to there is no cookie cutter, beautiful little tool or methodology we can pull off the shelf and implement with 100% fidelity and all will be fine and the change will happen. It's a much more messy endeavor than that, which anybody would probably echo who's leading change right now.
Absolutely. And I was at a conference at Harvard University a couple of months ago. One of the speakers I saw actually talked about the fact that from his perspective, when we talk about organizations coping with change and their ability to cope with change, he was saying that he actually believes the rate of change has literally exceeded people's ability to cope. He thinks we've actually gone over that particular threshold. Have you seen that?
Interesting. Yes, I would concur. I feel like we're still working off of what I call a 1980s model of change management. So imagine whatever your hairstyle was back in the 1980s. We're still using, a lot of folks are still using the old mental model of a bunch of senior people get together in a room over a couple of days, talk about the external environment, talk about what's happening internally, establish their goals and priorities for the next 3 to 5 years, and then pull together a plan. Traditional change management then involves communicating that plan up, down, across the organization with the general thought that everybody would get on board and do as instructed in the plan. And that approach isn't working. I would also counter that it didn't work terribly well back in the 1980s either. But I love what you mentioned that speaker said at the conference, and it speaks in large part to why so much of my work right now is back in K-12 in the education system, because that work for me, it really started after about 15 years of working with adults and leadership development and large-scale change, where it gradually began to dawn on me that so much of the work that we do in leadership development is helping adults unlearn what they learn through a standardized system of education. So that work then brought me to K-12.
Right. So really, really looking at change and learning from the ground up, it sounds like.
Yes, and I love how you mentioned both in the same sentence, because I've also come to understand that an organization's ability to change is directly proportional to the organization's ability to learn.
Absolutely. And so there are two kinds of change, right? There's technical change and adaptive change. And I think sometimes we don't really know the difference, and we don't even consider those differences. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So probably best illustrated through an example. If you take the example of an organization is deciding to bring in a new payroll software, that's a technical change, not technical as in it's software related, but technical as in you know what the desired end state is. You're pretty sure through your project plan what your milestones are, what that work looks like, who needs to be involved, where it's going to be funded, so on and so forth. An adaptive change, on the other hand, is much more nebulous. An adaptive change would be we sense that the external environment is shifting and we know that we need to do something different and we're not quite sure what that is. So let's start going out there, educating ourselves as to what is changing externally, bring that knowledge in, start talking to people up, down, across the organization, get a sense of where we might be headed and what our priorities should be moving forward. Maybe we need to shut down 80% of our business because we can see that 5 years from now, it's not a sustainable enterprise and we need to start thinking about fundamentally different streams of income. That's an adaptive change. It's, I think, best described as you've got a general sense of what the questions are and no idea what the answers are.
Right. And I can see why in some organizations, people shy away from addressing those adaptive changes then.
Yes, because nobody likes to sit in a meeting and answer the question with, I don't know.
Right, exactly. People really don't, unless you're in the rare organization that actually is open to that. Well, that's great, we don't know. Now we have something to look at and explore.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. One of the things I notice in organizations when I work in them sometimes is the leader will announce the change. And I know William Bridges, who you'll probably talk about during our conversation today, talk so much about by the time a leader has announced the change or the leadership team is announcing the change, they've gotten used to the idea of change. And they forget that when they announce the change to the rest of the organization, a lot of people are bowled over. They're like, what's going on? What, we're doing this, we're doing that, we're merging, we're moving. We have this huge change going on. And they just expect everyone to fall into line and get going with the change and implementing the change. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be this lack of awareness in some organizations and among the leadership that people need the same amount of time or similar amount of time to really get used to that change. And I'm just curious, how you've seen people handle that well. Have you seen anything that's worked well?
Great question. I think that the seat of it is how the leaders start to make the decisions around what needs to be changed. Now, sometimes there's a very clear call to action. A leader is brought into an organization to change X, and that's made explicit, and he or she moves forward on that. More often than not, though, leaders are scanning the environment to see what changes need to be made and making decisions accordingly. So the more that leaders can involve their employees and managers in that conversation, the much less of a shock it is that change is going to happen. It's also going to be a much better informed change, because the old days of being able to really know what's going on in your organization and making a good decision, not keeping yourself removed 4 or 5 layers from what's actually happening on the ground is pretty rare. So the more the actual decision making around what the change is going to be can involve as many people as possible in the organization, the less chance that it is that it ends up being a shock to people, and the more equipped people are to then help be implementers of that change.
Yeah, absolutely. A colleague of mine sent me a McKinsey Quarterly newsletter, and one of the articles was called Reorganization Without Tears, which I thought was very apropos.
Tears, T-E-A-R-S or T-I-E-R-S, or was that meant to be a pun or a turn of phrase?
It was a turn of phrase. Like, so how do we reorganize without people literally crying? And
good luck.
yeah, exactly. And it was a well-done article. And one of the things I noticed in it was they were talking about two of the traps leaders fall into. And we were just talking about this, but they talked about, you know, everything being kept secret to the last moment, which is always a bad idea. Mm-hmm. And the other one was what they called ivory tower idealism, which was the leader so excited about this change, whatever it's going to be, because it's going to make things so much better, address frustrations of the past, right, whatever it is, that this leader just cheerleads and says, this is just so amazing, it's so amazing, it's so amazing. And, of course, other people don't necessarily feel that way. Mm-hmm. And what that got me thinking about was, and I was curious if you had thoughts on this or what your thoughts were about this, was why is it that we can continue to make the same mistakes with making change in organizations when it's so well documented that it doesn't work? Right. It's something I think a lot about. Why do we keep doing that? Right. It's sort of like you said, the old school, the 1980s model of change management and these sort of these old ways of making change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of it goes back to industrial era management practices that many of us, myself included, were raised in a sort of a factory model of education, and then you go on to higher ed if that's what you decide to do, and then enter the workforce. And the culture, as you know more than anybody, Claudette, the culture in organizations defines how decisions are made, and the culture in so many organizations is based on industrial era management practices and management practices of control. Mm-hmm. And that being the case, when it comes to how do we lead change, there is this erroneous assumption that, you know, I need to make the decision, it needs to be right, and people need to follow me. Mm-hmm. And I love the literature around servant leadership and the need for us all to be a whole lot more humble around this work and to be learners in the process.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, this we go from this industrial model. We've gone into the information era, right? Now we're in this connection era, connection and learning era, and we still see some organizations back two eras. Mm-hmm. Really interesting, and that's fascinating in and of itself. How do we get those organizations moving forward, right? And what does it take for them to start looking at how they really need to operate so they don't get so far behind eventually that they literally fail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, and if it takes too long, then the organization invariably starts the path towards redundancy and becomes obsolete.
And on that note, we are going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the three different types of change, three aspects of change that will help organizations to hopefully not become redundant and continue to thrive. You are listening to Cultural Brilliance Radio, the DNA of organizational excellence. We're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to explore more of this really interesting conversation we're having about how organizations change and don't change. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Tune in to Lucid Planet Radio with Dr. Kelly Neff. This hit show will illuminate your senses and empower you beyond your daily stressors and hardships. Renowned psychologist and author Dr. Kelly will captivate you with far-reaching topics and amazing guests as you wake to the greatest version of yourself. Learn to tap into your intuitions, think critically about our world, heal emotional and psychological wounds, and follow your passions to live your dreams. The Lucid Planet. Welcome home. Visit lucidplanetradio.com for more information.
What is a brilliant culture? And how do we create them? Why are they important? Claudette Rowley has created a breakthrough five-step process to help you design a culture that is authentic, innovative, and successful. Learn how to create change with Cultural Brilliance Radio, the DNA of organizational excellence, and Claudette Rowley. To learn more or work with Claudette, visit ClaudetteRowley.com.
Get ready to experience Truth Talk Radio with host Deb Acker. Tune in to Truth Talk Radio each Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com to illuminate the truth in your daily life as you experience life, love, and abundance from a whole new perspective. This hit show will leave you feeling lighter and bring you into a place of infinite possibilities every day in every way. Visit TruthTalkRadioShow.com for upcoming transformative topics and guests.
On the cutting edge of the new mainstream, Christine Upchurch is passionate about bringing together science, psychology, and spirituality in a way that can be applied to our everyday lives for true transformation. The Christine Upchurch Show, stellar conversations to illuminate your journey, engages some of the most outstanding visionaries on the planet in lively dialogue to inspire you to become that bright light you're meant to be. Join Christine every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time on KKNW, AM 1150, and Transformation Talk Radio.
We're back on Cultural Brilliance Radio, the DNA of Organizational Excellence. I'm Claudette Rowley, and my guest today is Julie Wilson, a leadership and change expert, and we're having a great conversation about how organizations change. What is the state of change, the reality of change in organizations today? And you know what, Julie, before we continue, though, I want to make sure everybody listening knows how to contact you. Could you give us your website or your contact information so people know how to get in touch?
Sure thing. So my website for the Institute is the-ifl.org. So that's THE-IF, as in Frank, L.org. And the best email address to reach me is jwilson, W-I-L-S-O-N, at the-ifl.org.
Great. Thanks, Julie. So we're moving on to talking about three aspects of change, right? We have three of the main ones: strategic planning, change leadership, and transition management. And when I was thinking about those three types of change, three aspects of change, one of the things that struck me was, at least in my experience, when I've done strategic planning in organizations, interestingly, people don't always think of strategic planning as a form of change. They think we're planning, not that we're changing. Right? That we're planning. And we're going to implement. And we're not necessarily changing. And I was curious what you've seen around strategic planning.
So I've seen the two ways, as it were, of strategic planning. I have seen the strategic planning where nothing happens. And that usually is as a result of folks sitting in a vacuum in a room together, coming up with a plan and not reaching out to folks internal and external to the organization. Usually there's a nice pretty plan is drawn up as a result of that work, and it goes to what I call binder heaven, which is that fifth shelf on your bookshelf. Never sees the light of day.
Right.
There's another version of strategic planning where you bring your folks in to the planning process. First of all, to understand where you've been, understanding what the context is in which we're currently working and what some potential future scenarios might be that would present challenges and opportunities for the business. And a tool I oftentimes like to use with groups, particularly in organizations that have been around for some time, is a tool from the Grove Consultants out in San Francisco. They do a lot of visual planning work. And sometimes we don't use the visual planning as much as we could. It's a wonderful tool. And they have something called the graphic history, which really helps to take the organization back to its original DNA and how the organization started. And in that way, you're meeting people where they are and having the conversations that will lay a really solid foundation for discussing the external and internal realities and what changes might be needed moving forward.
That sounds like a great tool, right? When we start, we move out of sitting around a table and only talking about things and diagramming and making charts and really bring it to life more visually, right, and creatively.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And when we think about strategic planning and change, so assuming that we're actually going to use strategic planning to make a change, right, not go to binder heaven or, you know, put it in your filing cabinet drawer and forget about it, right, or use it as a paperweight,
yes.
The plan to print it out, right? When is the best time to actually start strategic planning and a change process? Sometimes the organization's just like, oh, you know what? Maybe we should do a strategic plan. That mm-hmm. would be just a thing to do. You know what? We're all going to get together on January 5th and we'll do a strategic plan for the year. That's what mm-hmm. we'll do.
It seems a little ad hoc.
Yes. I think it depends on the organization. So you might be just, you know, if you're in startup, for example, oftentimes the only purpose of a strategic plan is to get funding mm-hmm. because everybody knows that plan will bear little reality whenever events start to unfold, because who the heck knows what's going to happen? You're throwing stuff up against the wall to see what's going to stick. So the strategic planning is usually used as a business planning process to get funding in the startup stage. But as you start to move through the early stages of growth, you can find oftentimes that things start to fall through the cracks, that you don't have the systems and processes in place in order to scale the organization. So oftentimes when things aren't working, that's a good indication. Hold on a minute. Are we all on the same page here? And mm-hmm. if we're not, we need to start talking about who we are, where we're headed, and everybody's role in that process. So, you know, there is the approach where every certain number of years, a specific strategic planning process takes place. My view is, if you were to stop anybody in the hallways of an organization and ask them what the top priorities of the company are, if they can't answer that question, then you need some sort of planning. You need some sort of either planning or communication with regards to where the organization is headed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Everyone should be able to answer that question. Mm-hmm. I was actually talking, I was leading a training yesterday with leaders and managers and on performance management, and someone in the room is from a large bank. A couple people from the room are from a large bank, and they said, we were doing an exercise on culture. And I encouraged everybody from similar companies to get same company to get together and work on this question around culture. And they said, you know, there's really no point in us sitting together because we're so siloed that it's like we're in two completely different organizations.
Wow.
And one person, yeah, wow. And one person said, she said, I don't even know the mission of our bank, to your point.
Wow.
You know, I've been there about a year. I don't even know because we're just so isolated in what we do.
Hmm.
And it was really interesting. And yeah, that sometimes people just don't know the mission anymore. They don't know what their vision is. There's no obvious purpose, right? Other than to mm-hmm. come to work and get your particular job done.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that can lead to a lot of fracturing within the organization. And depending on the balance sheet and how well funded the organization is, that could go on for decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it kind of eats away at people's souls, I think.
Yes.
Not advisable. Even if you can go on for decades, not a good idea.
Yes. So, and in the absence of that purpose, then what happens is the importance of relationships takes over the actual work. And that's when politics become the currency du jour. Mm-hmm. And then we start to lose focus on the work itself. And it becomes, you know, various factions of fiefdoms and it can get pretty toxic.
Yeah, that's really interesting, right? When you're not focused on growing as an organization, right? The energy starts heading into relationships in a negative way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of relationships, that's making me think about change leadership, right?
Mm.
Which ideally is about relationships, although sometimes it's not. So when we say change leadership, though, what are we really talking about?
So I have my own definition of it, Claudette. Other folks might have something different, but when I think about the three aspects of change, so strategic planning, change leadership, and transition management, I think of change leadership as leadership of yourself.
Mm.
And this is an area that I think oftentimes leaders shortchange.
Absolutely.
I think about that metaphor when you're on the plane and the flight attendant instructs you to put your oxygen mask on before you administer oxygen to others. Leading change can be extraordinarily difficult, and I've seen it burn people out, like literally burn them out and put them in the hospital. And the importance of knowing who you are, so that the self-awareness piece, and also how you're managing yourself through the change, because people will take their cue from you. And there are moments when it makes sense to stand up in front of a group and be vulnerable and talk about your own learning in this process and what you know and what you don't know. And then it's appropriate to stand up and to be very clear on where the organization is headed and to have that level of clarity, purpose, and insight. On any given day, you might find yourself in different conversations where different things are needed. And the more adaptive the change, the bigger sort of the personal toll that will be on you as a change leader.
Yeah, absolutely. It's making me think then about if you're a leader of yourself, right? The leadership of yourself, which is so, my experience, so vastly overlooked and underrated. I think so many issues in organizations would actually naturally begin to get resolved if our leaders were incredibly self-aware in the way you just described.
Amen.
Yeah. And I think also it makes me think about, as you were saying, this thing, you know, we talk about called balance, right? But whatever that looks like, how are you going to not burn yourself out during this kind of a change, right? How do you maintain all aspects of your physical, emotional, and mental health? How do you maintain your emotional intelligence during something like this, right? And your ability to handle your thoughts and emotions. I mean, it's a really big task to lead change, especially in adaptive change.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Pretty incredible. And what about transition management? When we talk, what are we talking about there?
So transition management, essentially leading others through change. So this is the human part of change in organizations. And oftentimes it can be an afterthought, and it's usually under the heading of, why are these people resisting the change? How can we brainwash them into doing something different?
What's wrong with these people? Right.
Why can't they get on board?
Right, right.
Resistance is a sane response to a very scary situation. And transition management recognizes that in order for the change to actually take place, we need to meet people where they are. And there's nobody better than William Bridges to describe this. And he talks about the ending, the neutral zone, and the new beginning. And with any change, the vast majority of people are somewhere between the ending and the neutral zone. And the neutral zone is that scary place where we don't know where we're headed necessarily or how we need to change. All we know is that something has ended and we're now into an area of unknown territory. And there are ways in which organizations can help their employees through those stages.
And speaking of transitions, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk more about William Bridges in just a minute. I'm Claudette Rowley, and you're listening to Cultural Brilliance Radio. When we come back, we'll dive into some of the different change models and tools that are out there, what works and what doesn't, and how we can help our organizations transition through change. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
What is a brilliant culture? And how do we create them? Why are they important? Claudette Rowley has created a breakthrough 5-step process to help you design a culture that is authentic, innovative, and successful. Learn how to create change with Cultural Brilliance Radio, the DNA of organizational excellence, and Claudette Rowley. To learn more or work with Claudette, visit ClaudetteRowley.com.
Everybody, we're back on Cultural Brilliance Radio. I'm Claudette Rowley, and I have Julie Wilson here with me today. In case you're just joining us, Julie is a change management and leadership management expert and also the founder of the Institute for the Future of Leadership. And so we are going to talk more about, Julie, we were just talking about how to transition through change, right? and some of the different change models and tools that are out there. You were starting to share some of William Bridges' work with us on transition. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's most important when organizations are going through these really tough transitions sometimes?
So a couple of tools that I found to be helpful from the Bridges framework. One is something that he calls the four P's. So the first P is for purpose. Why are we changing in the first place?
Mm-hmm, right. Good question.
That can be a fascinating exercise.
Often overlooked. Right.
If you're sitting around a table, be it a senior, a boardroom table or middle managers or, you know, a large town hall meeting, and if you were to ask to go around the table, why are we changing? Oftentimes there is little alignment around that answer. Mm. So being very clear about the why, mm-hmm. why we're changing, that's P. First P is P for purpose. The second P is P for picture. So the leaders, one of the big jobs for a leader in change and transition is to paint that picture. What does it look like? If I were a movie director, you would describe that scene to me. What is that future to which we're headed? What does it look like? What does it feel like? Mm-hmm. The third P is plan. So how are we going to get from here to there? The recognition being that sometimes we're not entirely sure, but it's important to tell people what we know. So this is what we know with regards to next steps. These are the various sort of committees, task forces that have been formed to, you know, noodle through these different questions. And then once they come up with their plans, we'll aggregate and move forward. Whatever the plan is, making that explicit and communicating it to folks. And then the fourth P is part. So what's my part in this? Mm. And ideally, you're telling this story, you're articulating the purpose, painting the picture, describing the plan in such a way that people can really see what their part is in the change moving forward. If I can't see my part in the change, then it's unlikely that I'm going to be on board or be part of helping implementing the ultimate change that we want to see. So that's a tool that I love from Bridges, the four P's.
It's so thorough. I love it. How comprehensive it is. Like you said, we sometimes forget to talk about the why mm-hmm. of why we're actually changing, what it would look like, how are we going to get there, and what's my part in it. And I see organizations sometimes maybe do one or two of those mm-hmm. and skip the others.
Yeah. Yes. And the second tool that I also like from Bridges is the great acronym GRASS. So in the neutral zone, you find yourself in the grass. And what we typically experience in the neutral zone is some combination of guilt, resentment, anxiety, stress, and self-absorption.
Mm.
It's a wonderful, wonderful soup. and it really speaks to being in the messy middle. And too often leaders translate that as resistance and people are not on board. Mm-hmm. And Bridges talks about how people don't resist change, they resist the transition.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the part that's unknown. Mm-hmm. And that's the part with which people need help. And change is oftentimes an external event. It's a thing and it's mm-hmm. external to us. Transition is internal. So an example would be, I moved house earlier this year from Marblehead to Cambridge. That took place in one day. The moving truck got loaded up, we put the boxes in, we drove down to Cambridge that evening. I was in my new place. That happened in one day. Mm-hmm. So that change was pretty quick. The transition, however, is going to take a longer time. The transition to me feeling like this place is my home, that mm-hmm. will take longer. And things like visiting a friend and taking the turn off to go home to Marblehead and realizing, you know, 5 miles down the road, I'm on the wrong road. I don't live there anymore. I need to get onto Mass Pike instead. Mm-hmm. It takes us a while, and any good change process in an organization understands the humanness of it and what it takes to actually lead human beings through that change. And I oftentimes think of the metaphor of running a marathon. So quite often the folks who are taking the lead and planning the change, they're essentially running out front. And the folks who haven't been as involved in the planning process, they're towards the back. And mm-hmm. trying to, quote, hurry those folks up to the front of the line when you're an hour ahead in a marathon is an unreasonable expectation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it absolutely is. That's such a great metaphor for what changes can be like. And I do, that's one aspect of Bridges' work that I really love, which is how he talks about transition as the psychological event of change, mm-hmm. the psychological process. Change is event, but we go through this psychological process. And wonder why we can't just snap, hop to, right? We can't just mm-hmm. make it happen. We can't. And it's literally because we actually can't, because we're in the middle of an internal process.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about some of the other models, like Cotter, right? That's a very classic change model. Tell us about that and how that fits in or not with today's world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've always liked Cotter's model, his 8-step model for change. And it was Cotter's work out of the business school at Harvard that brought some data around the efficacy of change management or lack of efficacy. And according to his research, anywhere in the region of 70% of change initiatives fail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that can be a discouraging statistic, but I oftentimes look to the other side of it, which is that means 30% of change initiatives succeed. So what are those folks doing that works, and how might we do more of that? And I love Cotter's recent addition to the model in his book Accelerate, where he sort of augmented the 8 steps with what he calls the dual operating system. So for those organizations who've been in existence for some time, you have this change function, the work that's happening to change, but at the same time, you need to keep the trains running. So if I take the example of working in schools, you can't just stop the functioning of school while we go off and work out our future, where we're headed and what we would like that to be. You need to keep the trains running. But what oftentimes happens in organizations is these are two parallel paths and there's little or no communication between both entities. So there needs to be a very clear line of communication between the group and the folks who are deeply embedded in the change work with the broader organization, which is keeping the trains running. And I love that phrase that he has, the dual operating system.
Mm. Yeah, that's such a, I love that. Thanks for sharing that with us. It's so fascinating. And when we hear, 70% of change initiatives fail, and I've heard that as well. It can be disheartening. And so, like you said, we think about the 30% that did work, and it's fascinating to find out why they actually did. And I'm wondering if it has anything to do with the other model that you talk so much about, liminal pathways. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this is another model, somewhat similar yet different to Bridges, by Gisela Wending. And Gisela has done a lot of work around the internal process of change, and how here in the Western world, we don't really do a great job of helping folks through that process. And she talks about other cultures where, for example, a young child goes off into the wilderness, leaves their clothing behind, they have a task to accomplish while they're out in the wilderness, and then they come back and they're literally given different clothes, a different name, and they're treated differently by the community. That's a very structured process that will help that child move from adolescence to adulthood. And the phrase that Gisela talks about is the crucible, and mm-hmm. and how there really is a dissolving that takes place. And the deeper the change, the more recognition needs to be given to that dissolving. And I remember as a kid learning about caterpillars and butterflies. And I had this assumption that a caterpillar just sort of went into the chrysalis and grew wings and came out magically with these wings. What I didn't realize until the teacher informed us was that the caterpillar actually dissolves.
Mm-hmm.
That
interesting.
Is scary as hell.
Right. It's actually going to dissolve. Yes.
Actually going to dissolve. So we are certainty seeking machines as human beings. We want to mitigate risk where we can. And it's not often talked about in change management in a corporate environment, but there does come a point of surrender
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
where you're yielding yourself to a process and you're not quite sure who you are or what the organization is going to be when you come out the other side.
Yeah, and those of us who have organizations that have been through change, those of us as individuals who have been through big changes, to know that experience of that part of things, of the process, where you, like you said, it's uncertain. You literally don't know exactly what's going to happen. You may not have a lot of control over parts of it, except your response. Mm-hmm. And that can just be really, really scary.
Mm-hmm.
That phase. Yeah. Takes a lot of courage.
Massively so. Mm-hmm. And you know, back to the education system, we don't have the tools for that as human beings. Well, it's something that, you know, I fundamentally believe if we had more of that structure in our education system, we would be better equipped as adults in order to be able to navigate these kinds of transitions, because the speed of change is only going to accelerate. And the coach that you mentioned at the conference earlier, Claudette, who talked about the pace of change being incredibly rapid and how we are very much catching up. We are very much behind in our skills, knowledge, habits of mind, and way of viewing the world to be able to navigate the kind of changes that are upon us.
Absolutely. You know, my son, who's 14 and he's in eighth grade, said to me the other day, we were talking about which he skis in the winter, and we were talking about whether he's going to ski on Saturdays or Sundays for these 10 weeks. And he said, I want to ski on Saturday because I skied on Saturdays last year and I don't want to change things up, which is very him. He's not a change oriented person really. But it was interesting to hear that, because I'm a little bit different. Like, I might change it up. I might think more strategically about what's best right now. Mm-hmm. And he's 14, right? He's not an adult, but I thought that was interesting. And how we approach change can partly be personality, right? It can be upbringing. It can be our different perspectives on it. And whether we embrace it and think it's, even though it might have scary parts or challenging parts, we think that it's going to lead somewhere good most of the time, or whether we mostly sit in resistance around change because we just don't want the uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like we need more skills around handling uncertainty and coping with it.
Yes. I think that's a class we should all sign up for.
Right. Yeah. So one of the things I think a lot about, and I'm certainly thinking about it during our conversation today, is from your perspective, what is the change model we really need? Like, what have you seen? Like, if we could create any change model, what would it look like?
I'm going to need to think about that, Claudette. Let's go for a break and I'll think about it.
Big question, right? It's almost like we could put together, we probably could bring the best of all these change models are great, of course, right? But the ones mm-hmm. that the aspects of each of the model that are most appropriate for our needs now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And start putting them together. That's what I think about. You know, like, we could take the best of all of them. We could send all of our leaders to an emotional intelligence, emotional agility course, self-awareness course.
Mm-hmm.
So they could lead their organizations much differently and have that self-awareness we were talking about, that leadership of self.
Mm-hmm.
So many. It would be a fascinating prospect. Fascinating prospect. So before we take a break, though, can you share, Julie, would you share your contact info one more time?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure thing, Claudette. So the web address is the-ifl.org. So THE-IFL.org. And my email address is jwilson@the-ifl.org, THE-IFL.org.
Great. Thanks so much. This is Cultural Brilliance Radio with Claudette Rowley. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we are going to talk about something we haven't talked about yet, which it's not necessarily about tools and models. We're going to backtrack a little bit, right? And actually talk about the importance of context in change, that context really, really matters. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Wow. Hey, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to the Dr. Pat Show. This is Talk Radio to Thrive By. I'm telling you, I got to pinch myself some days, because when each of us gets called to do something that we so not thought was in our wheelhouse to do for a purpose that's so much greater than us, we get to show up and shine.
If you would like to show up and shine on the Dr. Pat Show as a co-host or sponsor, send us an email to inspire@thedrpatshow.com.
What is a brilliant culture? And how do we create them? Why are they important? Claudette Rowley has created a breakthrough five-step process to help you design a culture that is authentic, innovative, and successful. Learn how to create change with Cultural Brilliance Radio, the DNA of organizational excellence, and Claudette Rowley. To learn more or work with Claudette, visit ClaudetteRowley.com. How would you like increased health and vitality? How would you like to avoid the onset of disease as well as slow the aging process? This is all possible through a simple, safe, and natural process. Every day, we are either moving toward wellness or away from wellness.
Hi, I'm Mary Jane Mack. I'd like to be your partner in achieving optimal health. Contact me now at MaryJaneMack.com or call 425-392-0659. Visit MaryJaneMack.com.
Is traditional medicine not working for you? Do you still feel as if your health isn't 100%? Here at the Holistic Medical Center, Dr. Nushin Darvish and the qualified staff look through the dimensions of wellness and start a healing plan prioritized to your needs. Our physicians assess the whole you until complete health is achieved. Get the help you need by visiting drdarvish.com or call 425-451-0404.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Claudette Rowley of Cultural Brilliance Radio, and I'm here with Julie Wilson. For those of you just joining us, we are talking about the reality of change and what it takes to change in organizations. And one thing we haven't talked about yet, Julie, is the issue and the importance of context in organizations and context during a change. So tell us about this. What do we need to know about context, and what do we tend to miss?
So when it comes to context, and this is something that I've noticed when I'm working with leaders, usually in a coach capacity, as they enter into a new organization. And sometimes leaders can take their previous context with them and assume what worked in the prior organization will work in this new organization, or even moving internally within an organization, moving from one department to another, assuming that what worked in one department will work in this new department. And it's important for leaders to pause and really get a sense of where their organization is and what's needed moving forward. So it might be a question of just you're keeping the trains running, sustaining success, and you're really trying to refine things. It might be more of a startup situation where you're, you know, trying to, with massive force to get something up and running. It might be a realignment where you're trying to reorient things within the organization. It really depends on your context, which strategy is the most helpful, and really listening to what the environment is telling you, and then checking your understanding either with your senior team or your board. Because sometimes even within a board context, your board might be divided. Some folks might think, well, it's a realignment, and others might say, no, it's a complete turnaround. We need to turn around this organization. And there are big implications for the strategy that you choose to really manage change within those different contexts.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that keeps striking me during our conversation today is the importance of, and I think often overlooked, the importance of asking the initial basic questions to the leadership team. Like, are we in agreement on the context we're in, right? Mm-hmm. We talked about earlier, are we in agreement about the purpose of the change? Mm-hmm. Are we all, right, when we think about how we want to lead our organization, are we all on the same page? And I think that step is skipped so often, and it is incredibly contextual.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I've sat in a room where a board was meeting to discuss a particular change, and the person who was leading that change was presenting the updates. And it was really clear after 15 minutes that at least half of the board members did not support the change.
Mm-hmm.
So you can only imagine sort of the impact of that in their respective departments, and that per person who was out there leading the change, he would stand a pretty low chance of success. If your board is not aligned, essentially you're sending somebody out to the firing line.
Absolutely.
So taking the time to slow down at that level, at the board level, and making sure that folks have a shared understanding of the context, are aligned on the purpose, the why for the change, what the picture of success will look like, before starting to commit resources to go out there and actually implement the change.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think of context too with my work with organizational culture, and which are, you know, culture and context in this case could be almost the same, but the symbiotic relationship between the culture or the context and then the people operating within the particular culture or context. And I sometimes hear organizations, and I'm sure you do too, talk about culture as though it's this separate entity that we can park off in the corner. We'll just put our culture off in the corner and we'll kind of visit if we want to, but we don't need to deal with it on a regular basis. And it, of course, is just in like your example with that board, your board meeting you were sitting in on, always operating. Right. So if your context is we don't all agree on this change, but someone started to just push it on us and we're, you know, hoped we'd just all eventually go along, which is a common strategy I see, most likely it's going to backfire, and that people need to really be understanding what context they're in almost always.
Yes, and you're speaking there as well, Claudette, to the need to have difficult conversations.
And
oftentimes as adults, we haven't built that skill set where we avoid conflict at all costs, or we don't have productive conflict and we're not really engaging in a conversation where we can increase our understanding of where we are. And I love the phrase that I think was coined by Patrick Lencioni, the author of Five Dysfunctions of a Team, where he talks about artificial harmony.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
And a great litmus test for that is, have you been sitting in a 3-hour meeting and then you walk outside the meeting room doors and the real meeting takes place in the hallway?
Yeah, absolutely. Or organizations where I sit in on the meetings and they're boring. Because it's just reporting and nothing of substance is really actually occurring. And as you said, then the real meetings happen afterwards, right? About 8 different meetings happen after that meeting. And people's different offices are over the phone. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
It's those boring meetings where you want to literally unfurl a paperclip and start stabbing yourself in the eye. Get me out of this living hell.
Right. Definitely. We've all been there sometimes. So one of the things I know we had started talking about a little bit earlier in the show was this idea of, if we could create any change model we wanted, what would we create? And, you know, and as we started to talk about context, I realized that, you know, that would be an integral part of it. And I was curious if, you know, any thoughts or ideas are coming to you around, like, what would that change model look like? Or how would we incorporate the context piece?
Yes. I think of the ideal change model as being a tapestry where we're not saying we have these separate little functions of change, like strategic planning, change leadership, transition management, context. Yes, they are separate, but they are highly interdependent. So your strategic planning needs to take your context and, you know, as, you know, something front and center. When you're planning, you also need to bring people along from the get-go. So how you do that and incorporate that into your overall planning process from day one, not, you know, 1 year later after plans have been decided, and then how you're managing your own leadership, your own change leadership during that process. And I think of these, I used to think of it, to be honest, as a Venn diagram where there would be overlap in the middle. But now I'm thinking of it as a beautiful tapestry where each of these are strands in that tapestry. And the more they're woven together, the stronger your change process will be.
That is a beautiful vision. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. You know, I was really inspired by and hopeful hearing that, right? This could actually work. If we implement this in organizations, that could really, really work. And on that note, Julie, in addition to sharing this ideal motto with us, which is wonderful, what would be your personal message to folks today who are listening?
My personal message, I'm going to go meta.
All right. I love meta.
So after doing this work for almost 2 decades at this point, there is a theme which is becoming really clear to me, And that is, you will not change an organization unless you yourself are changed in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know what that is from the outset, but there is something there for you as a change leader to learn mm-hmm. in this process. And the more that you can be explicit about that, the more you can really dig into your own learning in that, and the more you can make that explicit to the folks you're leading, the mm-hmm. more powerful your change will be, because change is essentially learning. And my personal message would be, don't think of yourself as a change leader. Think of yourself as the leader of learning in your organization.
Mm, I love that. Leader of learning in your organization, not leader of change. Beautiful. And that perspective, I mean, just even in the second I've heard that, right? That gives us a completely different perspective, a different way of looking at change and how we participate and how we lead it.
Yes, it makes it okay not to know the right answer. It makes it okay to fail. It makes it okay to take risks.
Absolutely. So thank you so much, Julie, for joining us today and sharing such great information, such great stories and examples that really brought the reality of change to life. And I love that we came full circle to really talking about this vision for the future of how change could happen in organizations. You know, this perspective of being a leader of learning, of it's okay not to know, it's okay to take risks and make mistakes. It's a great note to end on. And I want to thank all of you for tuning into Cultural Brilliance Radio. I'm Claudette Rowley. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm here twice a month talking about all different kinds of aspects of organizational culture, change, and how we can continue to improve our world. So have a great week, and I'll look forward to seeing you next time.
You've been listening to the hit show Cultural Brilliance Radio, the DNA of organizational excellence with Claudette Rowley. Conversations that are transforming the world of culture and business. You can download this podcast and find out more about Claudette and her breakthrough work at ClaudetteRowley.com. Please contact Claudette and find out how you can create a brilliant culture.